Today is April 23rd, 2014, and this is episode number 251, if I remember correctly, of the Apple Context Machine, a podcast for the Mac Observer. I'm Brian Chaffin, co-founder, co-publisher of the Mac Observer.
And I'm Dave Hamilton, resident cough drop addict. To get the full story on anything we cover in this podcast, you can visit macobserver.com/ACM. And if you'd like to comment on or question anything about or in the show, shoot us a note at acm@macobserver.com.
Dave, what happened to Jeff?
Jeff is busy birthing or something. I don't know.
Boy, we're going to have something to talk about next week then.
I imagine you will. Let me pave the way for you here.
Yeah, that's excellent. That's excellent. No, thank you very much for coming and doing the show with me today while Jeff is actually out. We both appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure. It's good to be here. I'm glad the schedule worked. Yeah,
it is fun. It reminds me of that time I did the Geek Gab. Oh, that's right. I didn't do the Geek Gab.
Yeah, we could have you on the Geek Gab.
I want to be on the Geek Gab.
All right.
You guys are like a big deal.
Yeah. You may not know this, but we're kind of a big deal. That's what I tell my kids all the time.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
Although now and then my kids get to experience like people that know me from the website or the show or the podcast or whatever. But it's not often, but they've all seen it. They've each seen it enough to where they like, oh yeah, whatever.
<That's good. laughs> We don't want to be reminded that our dad actually is a big deal.
Right. The first time it happened was we were picking up the iMac, an older iMac at the local Mac shop. It wasn't an Apple store. It's an authorized service place. And I went to pick it up and, you know, gave my wife's name and said, but I'm Dave Hamilton. And they all kind of stopped. And they're like, oh, wait, we know your voice. And it all started. And so my daughter got to see some of that. And then we left and we get in the car. She's like, what was with those geeks?
They pay the bills, honey.
That's how it works.
That is so funny. I very much, I haven't listened to it yet, but I very much am looking forward to listening to the Morning Zoo show you guys did this week.
Well, we do a lot of shows in the morning. It just happened to be that this one was on a Monday.
Do you have, you know, like honking horns? This is Dave Hamilton in the drive time.
No. We leave that to No Agenda because they do a great job of parodying the whole in the morning thing.
Fair enough.
So, yeah. Now, the morning shows are good.
That's good.
For lots of reasons.
Yeah. I'm not a morning person. But anyway, listen, we have another show to do today. We're doing the Apple Context Machine. This, Dave, is where we talk about stuff that's going on in the Apple world and try to provide context for it.
I like it.
You like it?
I can do
right?
that.
All right.
Sure.
Excellent. Excellent. You may have heard of us. We're kind of a big deal.
You're kind of a big deal. That's right.
So, listen, I want to hit you up with the first topic of something that you actually wrote for TMO this week.
Really?
Yes. Your thing on upgrades. You claim this is a golden age of upgrades. I call balderdash.
No, it really is. See, you know, we started, and we've been talking about this on Mac Geek Gab, and we're going to talk more in a much more geeky way, but in sort of a contextual way. For here, we Mac users, there was a great divide that happened starting in 2006. Prior to that, when we started TMO, upgrades were a huge deal. There were upgrade companies that have gone out of business since then, some that haven't, obviously, but tons of them, right? And we were constantly looking at upgrading our CPUs or upgrading our RAM or adding a faster spinning hard drive or, you know, whatever we could do to eke more performance out of our Macs.
And a lot of that came out of the clone eras, too. A lot of the technology that went into the various companies that were making these upgrade cards, in particular, the processor upgrade cards, was technology and people that came from some of the clone makers.
Oh, that's total. I had forgotten about that piece of it. You're absolutely right. Yeah. It was a good time.
But it was fun.
You know, it was a different time for a lot of reasons, but it was the time at which a CPU upgrade actually made a difference for the average user, right?
Mm-hmm.
The CPU was slower than the bus, or especially the hard drive sometimes was slower, was faster than the bus that it was connected to, and like all of this stuff. And the same with the CPUs. You increased your CPU speed, and you immediately saw like this huge benefit.
Mm-hmm.
a couple of things have changed. One of them is that CPUs have gotten so fast that for most people, most of the time, you're not hitting that 100% CPU. You're not even hitting that 30% of your CPU for any extended stretch, right? You know, I mean, some of us do if we're doing audio processing or ripping movies with Handbrake or something. But in our general day-to-day, we're typically not.
Right.
But it doesn't matter because upgrading the CPU in a Mac is near impossible right now. I don't know of anyone that's doing it, even crazy people with soldering irons.
OWC is doing it for the new Mac Pros because they're socketable.
Because they're socketable, right, of course.
And that's it, and who knows how long that'll last.
Sure.
And it's expensive. Sure.
And it's way expensive, but it's also, that's not a consumer-grade machine either. In fact, I would argue that most people that buy Mac Pros, the new Mac Pro, are buying it because they're emotionally attached to the concept of a Mac Pro, not that they actually need that computer. Something far less expensive would probably suit their needs, for most
right.
of them.
Right.
There are some that do need that, and it's great.
But, I resemble your comment.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there's a lot of people that waited so long for a new Mac Pro. And then it came out, and it's like, but really, this iMac does all that I need. You know, it's hard to swallow, but whatever. But, you know, the big change that sort of, like, in one fell swoop killed 90% of the upgrade businesses out there was when Apple, back in 2006, did I get that right? Remembering that right?
I think it's my 2006. Article? I'm looking, 2005.
2005. Okay, well, in 2005, June of 2005, Apple announced that Intel was our friend, more than our friend. They were our future, right, as Mac users.
And the day before, they were our enemy.
They were our enemy. No, and this was one of the things that Steve Jobs was great at. Mm-hmm. You know, he would constantly tell you something, and it would be true right up until the moment he told you it was false.
It's so true, man.
He was good at it.
He was fantastic at it.
Yeah, so much so that you didn't even realize it was happening to you. But you look back, and you're like, right, of course. Yeah, that's what happened. But, you know, he did that, and then, you know, January of that year, they announced that in June, they actually shipped a computer to developers, which was an Intel-based Mac. And then in January, they announced, and very shortly after, started shipping the MacBook Pro and the iMac that were the first of
I think it's the other way around, just so that no one calls us on that, because what you wrote was that the announcement took place in June, which would have been WWDC, and then they shipped 7 months later.
Right, that's what I just said. In June, they actually shipped a developer version of the Intel Mac. So developers could buy this from Apple and get to work on it right away. But the consumer version of all of this, which was the MacBook Pro and the iMac, was announced at Macworld in January. And I remember we finished the keynote and I ran to the press room and ordered my Intel-based MacBook Pro.
That's right, I remember that.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, you know, I got it like a month later or something. It didn't take that long. So... but, you know, as soon as Apple had paved this Intel-based future, it really killed off the concept of even considering doing a serious upgrade to your older Mac for a long time, right? You know, you used to be able to stretch back 5 years, maybe more than 5 years, with a Mac and upgrade it and actually make it, you know, your daily driver. Mm-hmm. That went away, you know, and so we started into this cycle, which is good for Apple, good for business, of us buying new computers all the time, because it sort of took a little while for the Intel thing to settle in, and we needed the Core 2 Duo processors to be there to do the stuff that was going to need to be done and that still needs to be done.
Right.
So it took a couple of years, and then we went through some incarnations, and, you know, we've got all that we have now. But there are a lot of people out there, myself included. In fact, the machine I'm on included, the one I record the podcast on, using computers that are 6 and 7 years old. This is a 2007 iMac.
Hmm.
And you know, and it came with a 250 gig hard drive, which is fine for what I do with this machine. It's plenty of space. But this machine got so slow that if we had some sort of a problem where I needed to reboot, right, in order to, say, get the audio interface to work right or something, it was literally a 10-minute tour before I could even call my, you know, we do the podcast over Skype, as you guys do here, and it was 10 minutes before I could call John back. So this is not only a workflow interruption and a mindset interruption, but truly a 10-minute lag. before the computer was even beginning to be ready to be used again. And it and it's just because it had to load up everything and, you know, the reboot plus loading all the stuff I have in the background Dropbox and, you know, all that stuff. And then getting Yojimbo open, which I use, and Skype, which I use. And at no point during that process would this computer's CPU be pegged at 100%.
Sure.
And yet, clearly, the computer was working as fast as it could. So you kind of have to look at your computer holistically, right? And say, okay, well, what is the thing that's slowing it down? And that thing is the hard drive. And it's not even the speed of the drive so much as the accessibility of the data on the drive. And let me explain that, right? Because our hard drives can actually move data. Even the slowest, oldest hard drive that I had in this could move data at a fine clip once it got to reading that data for me. But when you tell a hard drive, go get me this tiny little file, which really is what's happening when you're booting up a computer or launching mail, tons of tiny files. Dropbox obviously is that. But, you know, everything is just tiny little files.
Mm-hmm.
And when you tell your computer to launch and read a tiny little file, it goes and it says, okay, and it tells the hard drive, go get, this file is located at this location, read me the contents of this file. And so what the hard drive does is says, hang on, and then it goes and it moves its little heads around to get to the spot where it can begin reading that file. And then it very quickly reads it for you and delivers the data. But that lag, that seek time, where it's going to move those heads, is killer, especially when you've got lots and lots and lots of little files, which, as I said, is what we do. So, you know, moving from a hard drive, a rotational hard drive, to a solid state hard drive or an SSD is a huge upgrade. And this has been true for 5 years.
Sure.
But because the SSD effectively, somebody's going to yell at me about this, but effectively it has zero seek time. You say, I want this file, and it says, here's the data. That's it. There's very little lag, almost no lag, and certainly compared to a rotational drive, no lag whatsoever. So that's kind of the trick. And once you do that, and once you boot up from one of those drives, you will see your CPU at 100% for a much shorter period of time. And this computer I did this upgrade to, it went from 10 minutes to probably about 45 seconds. Yeah. So much so that when you said, let's record, it used to be that if I was going to record a podcast, I would have to plan ahead. I would log in remotely, either from my iPad or from my MacBook Air or something, a half hour before, and launch all the apps that I need to have running and make sure I logged in. And then it would just take that amount of time, that 10 minutes or sometimes more, to really get truly settled. And I would have to plan ahead. This time, I went to do that because it's still sort of muscle memory for me. The upgrade only happened recently here, but I went to do it and I thought, no, I'm going to eat my own dog food here. And I sat down at my desk, in the studio, and I launched the apps I needed to launch. And then we called each other and it was no issue.
Hands weren't twitching.
My hands weren't twitching at all. No. In fact, I got everything launched and then realized, oh, I want to go get tea. Normally, I would have been sitting here for 10 minutes. I would have gone and gotten tea while that was happening. It happened so quickly that I didn't have idle time to think, well, what else can I do while I wait? Because that's how I am.
That's funny. All right. So let's talk about some practical issues.
Right. Well, 5 years. Go ahead. Yeah.
But SSDs are still a lot more expensive than the platter drives.
Absolutely. And 5 years ago, they were so expensive that while the upgrade still made great sense for anyone, it was really hard to justify the cost for most of us.
Yeah, unless you're made of money.
Right.
You know, just don't care about that little money thing.
Yeah. Yeah. But it, you know, it was like a $500 difference between a rotational drive and a solid state drive of equal size. Like, just no, it's hard to, you know, I could buy another computer, you know.
Some iMacs can take two drives. Right?
That's true, sort of.
And most of your Mac Pros, your towers, obviously can take multiple drives.
Mm-hmm.
But splitting, I mean, like, you know, if you've got a budget for 128 gig SSD or a 256 gig SSD, and you've got a terabyte of stuff or 2 terabytes of stuff, which, you know, a lot of us do.
Yep, I do. Yeah.
You know, what are you supposed to do, Dave?
Well, so I would say you go get the 256 gig SSD, because especially for your older computer, you can do that. What I found a bunch today that I put in the article, they're all in that $150 range, right? $150
for 256?
Yeah.
Wow, that's actually great.
Crucial has one, their M500 line, which is their lower end line, but is not going to make a difference in your older Macs. It's going to run the same speeds. But their M500 line, they've got 256s for $119.
Wow.
That's why I'm saying we're in this golden age of upgrades. Because of that. It's almost an impulse buy.
Well, then I retract my Balderdash.
I see what I'm saying?
what are the bigger sizes of that? What's a half a terabyte or three quarters of a terabyte? And are we still looking at a practical limit of 3/4 of a terabyte?
No, you can get a terabyte SSD nowadays.
Okay.
I mean, you know, the higher end, I'm looking on Crucial's website here, because today they seem to have the cheapest prices. But OWC, Kingston, SanDisk, and Samsung are all the players that you kind of want to watch here, because that's where the differences are made.
Right.
So the M500, they've got a 960 gig drive of the M500s for $443.
Oh, that's like
it's 50 cents a megabyte. It's a safe number. You might be at 55, you might be at 45, but yeah, 50 cents a gigabyte.
That's approaching affordable.
Absolutely. That's what I'm saying.
Huh.
Yeah. And I will say this, I didn't say it in the article, but you know, you might be tempted because I'm looking here. And if I go to their, you know, the M500 comes as a 240 gig. The M550, which is their faster kind of, you know, more state-of-the-art drive, comes in a 256. So slightly larger. But you're talking about 119 for the M500 and 168 for the M550. You might be tempted to say, hey, you know, I'm going to go get the slightly better one because that way I can take it with me to my next computer or whatever. I mean, it's not that much money. It's you know, less than $50. Don't do that. You're never going to take this drive out of that computer, right? You know, putting a drive inside a computer is a big problem. You're just going to sell it with that Mac.
Yeah, when it's not a Mac Pro.
When it's an iMac or a laptop, that's right. Yeah. Yeah. Which is what most people are going to upgrade. Right.
Right. And you're not going to want to when you go to sell it, you're not going to want to put your old drive back in it and take the new one.
Huh? No, you're just going to get a new, bigger, faster SSD that day.
Yeah.
You know, if you're putting an SSD in a computer to upgrade it now, you're probably going to wind up keeping that computer for at least another year or two.
Yeah, until platter drives. You know, Apple won't be offering any platter drives sooner rather than later.
Yeah, they're pretty close to that.
Pretty close to that now. Yeah, actually.
Yeah.
iMac still have platters in them.
So, you know, they do that whole Fusion Drive thing. I mean, the iMac I have is the one downstairs in the office is the 2011 iMac, which I got with 2 drives. It was before Apple announced the Fusion Drive. So officially my iMac doesn't support it. I could do it with core storage. It's really, actually, it's trivial, but I won't because it's a bad idea. Fusion drives are just a terrible idea. In terms of data integrity, but it has a 256 gig SSD. And a 1 terabyte spindle drive in
it,
and I manage my data appropriately that way.
Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, that's an interesting thought, man. It certainly is a way to get a lot more life out of your Mac.
I did this to my wife's computer this week. She's still on a 2008 MacBook Pro.
Okay.
Pre unibody, so early 2008.
Wow.
Yep, and it had gotten to the point where I wouldn't sit down at that computer and use it. I would like go and find my heir or you know, even come over to the office here. Because I've been spoiled by SSDs.
Sure.
And she was noticing it being slow too. And so I said, well, all right, well, let's do this experiment. So I bought her for that particular machine. I've tested this on several. And so I've got the Crucial drive in one and a SanDisk in one. And for that one, I bought an OWC drive for her. But the 240 gig Mercury 3G drive. So again, they're kind of lower end drive. And that was about $150 again. And I could have done the Crucial cheaper, but I wanted to test OWC. And I put it in, and her immediate comment was, holy crap, it's like you got me a new computer.
Wow.
Yeah. And which is the standard fair response for someone moving to an SSD, someone upgrading a computer to an SSD. It really is. And it has been for 5 years.
Well, let me ask one more question before we move on.
Yeah.
The difference between looking at the just to pick it arbitrarily, the M500 and the M550.
Mm-hmm.
Is anyone going to notice, are most people going to notice the difference between those two classes of SSDs?
It's a slight speed difference. With Crucial, the M500 versus the 550. The 500 reads at 500 megabytes a second. The 550 reads at 550 megabytes a second. The write speeds, the 500 writes at 400 megabytes a second, and the 550 writes at 500. So, there's some differences there. However, on your older Macs, chances are you only have a SATA 2 bus.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? The SATA 2 bus maxes out at 3 gigabits per second, which is effectively 300 megabytes a second. You're never actually going to see 300, but you'll get like 270 out of the thing. So
it's already faster than the bus.
It's already faster than the bus. That's right. You're not going to see it. And to be fair, you know, your hard drive, even a decent hard drive that came with it, probably doing about 80 at best, might be less than that. So jumping from 80 to 280 is a huge jump, even if you take out the most important part of the SSD, which is that whole elimination of seek time. When I first started testing SSDs, I did it on USB buses, which max out at 30 megabytes a second, right? So definitely they were running slower than whatever crappy hard drive I had and whatever the computer it was at the time. And it still boots like way fast. All those different, you know, that 10-minute to 1-minute boot time still happens when you do it over USB. So if you're afraid of upgrading your computer, or I should say, if you're afraid of opening up your computer, and trust me, after having been in and out of iMacs and using suction cups to pull the glass off and all of that stuff, I get it. I screwed up with this particular one. I must not have reconnected the temperature sensor properly, and so the fans were running like crazy. I could have gone back in and fixed it, or I could have gotten some software for about $30 that fixed it, and I spent the $30. It was like, you know what? I'm good. This computer's happy. Let me support a good developer.
Yeah, which is always a good idea.
Yeah, so if you don't want to do that, you can get a FireWire case for it. I would probably go FireWire just because if you get a FireWire 800 port on your Mac, it's going to go a little faster. You're still limiting the speed of the SSD, but you'll get a lot of benefit out of it. And then maybe just hang on to it. And if you've got a friend that says, "Oh, this is no big deal," then you buy them some beer and let them do the upgrade for you. Give them the beer afterwards. But I did it with my son, and I hate going. When I had my consulting business, I refused to work on laptops. I got to the point where that was it. I said, nope, I'm not opening another laptop. And iMacs are the same way as laptops. It's just layers, right? You got to peel everything off to get to whatever you want. And it really wasn't that bad. We did the iMac at the house and my wife's MacBook Pro in certainly less than an hour for both of them. This weekend we printed instructions from iFixit, and that was that.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. Good stuff, man.
Thanks.
Good stuff. Let's go to something completely different, to quote our friends over at Monty Python.
I didn't realize they were our friends. That's awesome.
Oh yeah, totally buddies. Well,
that's,
I mean,
freaking awesome. They realize we're a big deal, don't they?
Exactly. It's been. A couple of weeks now, we've had this new trial going on between Samsung and Apple. And okay. Samsung just rested its case on Monday, I think it was. And so we've got, I guess Apple is probably doing a little bit of response to whatever it is that Samsung says. It's 'cause Apple presented its case first, and Samsung did its thing, and then Apple gets a chance to respond. And on Tuesday... Recode first reported that Apple trotted out a deposition from a Google, I'm sorry, from a Samsung attorney who confirmed in that deposition that an email trail between Google and Samsung did in fact say that Google was indemnifying either fully or partially, we're not really sure, Samsung against some patent infringement claims for some things that are part of Android. So there were like this, to restate that, originally there were four patents that Apple was suing over that were part of Android as opposed to something that Samsung had done.
And okay.
Two of those patents were dropped. So you know, now we've only...
These are Apple patents.
Just thank you.
For clarification.
I knew I was saying that terribly. These were Apple patents, and Samsung agreed to indemnify, which means that if Samsung is found to have infringed, that Google would bear any liability for that infringement for some of the claims on two of those patents. And this is new information.
Sure. So Google's effectively saying what you did there was simply because we did that. And so therefore it's not your fault. It's our fault.
Right.
If
infringement is found in the first place. And Samsung also got Google to agree to pay for some of the defense costs, some of the legal fees and whatnot for defending against those same claims. And so, go ahead.
No, keep going, because I've got something to cap this all. But go ahead. Yeah.
Well, this was sort of balanced in my head when I was talking to someone in the legal profession a couple of weeks ago, who went on a spitting rant about how Apple was doing such a bad job of pursuing this case against Samsung. And in particular, for instance, one of the things that Apple, at least to us here on the outside, that Apple has done a very poor job of doing is making it clear to the jury that while customers may not have bought a competing infringing device based just on a couple of patents, when you look at Apple's patent portfolio as a whole, that's why they were buying them, because Samsung and Google were infringing upon all of these patents together. And it was Judge Koh who was artificially limiting the size of these trials to just a few patents. And when you divide them up like that, it is harder to make the case. And he was saying that, you know, Apple should have been doing a better job of making that case to the jury, saying that, you know, like, we tried to have these other patents involved here and the judge wouldn't let us, that sort of thing.
I'm no legal expert, but I play one all the time.
All the time.
Whether I'm on TV or not, right?
Yeah.
It seems to me that if the judge... that's one of those things that Apple probably couldn't make that claim to the jury without getting sanctioned by the court, right? We, the court, have already told you, you can't make that claim, and now here you are making it. You have the audacity to make this in front of me in my courtroom. Boom.
But there are other trials. You can talk about the fact that there are these other trials going on.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. Okay. So right. You do it creatively.
You know, these things. Yeah. Yeah. The one of the things that sparked this conversation with this person from me was I was looking for an opinion on why it is that Samsung was essentially lying and saying that Apple didn't use the patented features, which was just an outright lie. And his explanation to me, which really put everything in context, was that, look, this is what attorneys do. This is what they're supposed to do. They're supposed to make the best case they can for their client. When you're looking at a trial, a civil trial, you're not looking for justice. You're looking for your client to win. And this is
for damages, right?
Yeah, for damages. Yeah. And this is for good or for ill, mind you. I'm not saying that this is okay.
This is how our legal system works.
It is how our legal system works. And so if Samsung's attorneys could get away with lying, then essentially more power to them. It's like, oh, okay, that makes a little sense.
Yeah.
But in the back of my head this whole time, it's like, you know, why are Apple's attorneys kind of being so wishy-washy about all this? Why are they not... Why are they not taking it to, why are they not being more aggressive? You know, like Quinn Emanuel is the law firm representing Samsung. They are very highly regarded. Yes, they lost the first case, but it would have been like a monkey should have been able to win that case on behalf of Apple.
Sure.
Right.
Okay.
And then when we get this news yesterday, all of a sudden it's like, whoa, wait a minute. Apple just had entered into this legal train of thought here, this legal chain of custody even, that Samsung is responsible, or that Google is responsible for some of this stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, it's almost like, I've always seen this lawsuit against Samsung as Apple's, and let's be honest, Steve Jobs's attack against Google. Right. It had to start, well, it didn't have to, but they chose to start it with one of the device manufacturers in order to let, presumably, and this is in my mind, again, playing an attorney as I do 100% of the time with no training. But, you know, they had to pave the way for some precedent so that they could then take that, win against Samsung in whatever ways, test this, figure out what the angles are. And now they can go and sue Google, right? You know, and really lay it to them. That's to me, that was always sort of the plan.
There's a couple of aspects to this. First of all, some of the things in the first trial in particular that Samsung lost.
Yep.
Some of those features being sued over were A, design patents, which Google is not responsible for. And B, were things that Samsung added because Google had left it out because they knew that it was patented by Apple.
Of course.
Right. So this would be some of the utility patents. Right. And secondly, although, you know, this is one of the mainstream focuses on commentary about this has been that Apple was going after the companies with who are actually making money from this. Google doesn't make any money from Android. They give it away. Most of the money that Google does make on Android is actually coming from iPhone users and iPad users, but that's beside the point. Yep. But when with Google giving Android away for free, it's a lot easier to get money out of the hardware makers, but Apple doesn't care about the money. Apple wants the infringement to stop. Apple doesn't need $2 billion. And these trials have always been about stopping the infringement, not getting money. And that's something that the mainstream press doesn't seem to understand. And I had a point; it's gone.
Yeah. Well, right. Well, but it's this. I don't know. This is really interesting. It's either a really shrewd move on Google's part to, if they think that Samsung is going to win this, perhaps this is a way of Google's getting in on this and then being able to say, oh, whoa, whoa, down the road, we've already been sued for this. We already had risk. And there's, you know, you can't double jeopardize us. So therefore, you know, you lost against Samsung. You can't, you know, turn and change your tactics and come and fight us on the same issue.
But it's Apple that is making this point. Apple is the one who has introduced this into the court testimony.
Wow, that's true.
Isn't that interesting? That to me was the interesting part. Is why is Apple wanting to make an issue?
Well, maybe they're deciding. Maybe they're deciding. Okay, now we're in, all or nothing.
Well, yeah, and I think this is very much about setting the stage for a future trial against Google,
or making this a trial against Google. I mean, it would have to be a future trial, yes, but this could quickly morph and they could be named as a co-defendant.
Yeah, if Apple can win this infringement claim for these patents, I think it's the 414 patent and the 595 patent, whatever. One of them deals with background synchronization, and one of them deals with universal search, both features of Android. If Apple can win these two patent infringement claims, or the various claims against these two patents, to be technical about it, Apple, it will be a much easier case for Apple to make the same case against Google.
Right. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
And maybe that is the big picture. And maybe that's why Apple wasn't so worried about contradicting Samsung's attorneys, which is actually John Quinn. His assertions that Apple wasn't using these patents when Apple clearly is using these patents. I don't know. It's strange. I don't really know what to make of it.
Yeah, it's a fascinating thing.
It is a fascinating thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't have the magic answer, despite my sharpened legal mind, Brian.
Well, you know what? I don't either. And I, while I haven't played an attorney, I've certainly seen them on TV. And I still
don't
know.
That's all it takes.
It really is. This attorney thing is pretty easy, really.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, all right. Let's do it. Let's take a softball one.
Okay.
It was last night. We wrote about it this morning, but last night, Apple effectively opened up, not even effectively, they opened up Mavericks, the beta process, to the public. When was the last time they did that? I think it was OS 10.0.
That's right.
Why are they doing this? It's interesting.
Well, I can come up with some reasons why they are doing it, but it's also, I think, important to answer the question, why wouldn't they do this? Right?
That's a different question, though.
But it's not, right? Because I argue that I can make it the same question where we live now in a culture defined by Google, admittedly, of beta software being release software, right? I mean, we lived with Gmail for years as beta, right? You know, and people relied on it. But the other thing is they don't charge for Mavericks, right? It's free. So, and currently, or up until yesterday, the only beta testers they had, and let's be honest, when Mavericks came out, it was not stable. It was not good. It was very crashy, and Mail was a freaking disaster.
Mail was a mess for me, but it was always stable for me. I've heard other people have made the same charge, so yeah. I'm going to go with it. But I would like to point out that it was very stable for me. But Mail definitely had its issues.
Yeah, and Mail still has its issues.
Mail still has its issues.
And Mountain Lion was way better. At some level, we've all been using beta software, and Apple's just racing to patch these things, right?
Yep.
So that's number one. But number two, they're not charging for it. So why not open up the pool of beta testers to, instead of it just being developers and having this $99 cost of entry? And there were plenty of people that paid their $99 to get access to the betas. Never had any intention of buying the software. Now, that you could argue that's a profit center for Apple, but it also sort of muddles up their whole developer program and you know, better to keep those people out of it, frankly. I don't think the $100 makes a difference. So they're making plenty of money elsewhere. So, and I think this allows them to test on a wider pool without having to actually formally release an update that they say fixes things, and then find out, when the Great Unwashed started installing this, no, it didn't. So I think it's a smart move for them. At first, I scratched my head, but now that I think about it,
it is a smart move. Of course, no doubt it's a smart move, and no doubt would it have been a smart move for Apple to have done this a long time ago. That's why I was saying it's a separate question, because asking why the heck hasn't Apple been doing this, or if we'd asked this yesterday, you know, why doesn't Apple bloody well open up this stuff to the public? That is a debate. But now that they've done it, my question is, what switched internally in Apple?
Ask your question.
Why has Apple suddenly started doing what it should have been doing all along anyway?
Because they want to pave the way for 10.10. Which is presumably coming in a month, with the betas of which are coming in a month at WWDC?
A month and a half.
Yeah, okay.
Just a nitpick.
That's just nitpicking.
Yeah, I don't want people thinking that we're saying that it's going to come in May.
Fair enough. Yes. Thank you. Yep. No, it's good. So, you know, I think that's why. And I also think it keeps them from having to release patches, test patches to the public faster. Right. I mean,
for sure. But you know, so has someone realized this? Has someone convinced Tim this is the right thing to do? Did Tim convince them that it was the right thing to do? Do you think they're maybe addressing a problem? Was it some sort of like a, you know, was there a Steve Jobs mantra that the customer should never ever be dealing with beta software, and then you know, the realities of the situation have finally been overcome internally at Apple. I mean, it's.
I think you just hit it. I bet that's it. I bet that's it.
You think Steve might have been against the idea of ever allowing exposing customers to beta software, and then someone finally realizing, well, that's what we've been doing anyway.
Right, and this has existed. The OS X beta seed program is not new; it's just newly publicized and it's newly joinable, right? They have had customers that weren't developers that they have had in their you know, trusted grasp, and now it's like, yeah, whatever, you know.
I beta tested OS 8.
Yes, you did. I remember that.
Before it became OS 7.7.
Yeah, that's right.
To the chagrin of clone makers.
Yep. Yep. Yep.
Good times that was.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm certainly glad to see this happen. I mean, you know, it's for all the reasons that you said.
I'm curious about, though, is whether, because I'm a registered developer for a lot of reasons. One of them is this, right? But really, it's so that I can learn about the new software, so that when it comes out, we can talk about it with some experience without having to guess. That's really my main reason for doing it. And it works out fine. But one thing you get when you're a registered developer is really, truly, I'll say relatively good, some people may argue with me, access for bug reports. In fact, I'm in the process of dealing with a bug report now on a 10.9.3 thing. And they've been amazingly responsive on this, right? Clearly, it's an important issue for them to either figure out the solution or figure out that it's not a bug and it's just my issue, right? But, you know, they're focused on this. There are some things where they say, yep, got it, thanks, and then you never hear from them again. But I'm wondering how much interaction they're going to afford the people in the beta seed program versus developers. And that may be, again, part of this is able to split the workforce and say, okay, developers get this level of support. People in the beta seed program, it's sort of treated as a different tier, and splitting that out again might be might save them more than that $100 a year they get.
Hmm.
So we don't know. I mean, that's a big question. No one has any experience with that because the program is barely, not even 24 hours old yet.
Right. Right.
Or this new openness to the program.
Right. 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 I get what you mean there.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll just have to see where that goes. I have one more topic for you this week.
You do?
I do. It's a bonus fourth topic. The bonus fourth topic, Dave, is what's coming for the iPhones. Actually, let me ask that in a different way. I'll just edit myself out because no one will know what a blunderhead I am. What is Apple's iPhone lineup going to look like by the end of this year?
What is Apple's iPhone lineup going to look like?
So right now we've got, so last year we had a transition, right? We used to have a new iPhone, last year's iPhone, and a 2-year-old iPhone.
Sure.
Right. Last year we changed that. By we, of course, I mean the good folks at Apple. They did most of the work. We have a new iPhone that represents the middle of the market, and a 2-year-old iPhone.
Yeah, that's right. For the very low end.
For the very low end, right.
Quote unquote,
for the entry level of the middle of the market, right. Actually, to be honest. Right.
That's a great way to say it.
Because Apple doesn't address the actual entry level market.
No.
And We have all these rumors, credible rumors. Now, I'm 100% on board with the fact that Apple is finally going to be bringing an iPhone to market with a screen larger than 4 inches, probably 4.7.
Thank goodness.
All right. Thank goodness. Finally. Yeah. It's going to happen. It's going to happen this fall is where I think it's going to happen. I don't think it's going to happen during WWDC, which some people seem to bizarrely think is going to be the case. And the question, though, is what is the whole lineup going to look at? Are we going to have... Well, okay, what I think it's going to be is we're going to have a premium iFablet. We're going to have a premium...
When you say iFablet, this is now this 5-inch-ish
yes.
Phone.
Yes.
The iFablet. Okay.
Right, a large screen iPhone. So okay. We're going to have a premium large screen iPhone. We're yep. going to have a premium 4-inch iPhone. And then we're going to, I think we'll have an entry-level 4-inch iPhone.
So the 5C, the 5S, and the 6.
Yeah, the 5S's successor, the 5C's successor.
Oh, you think they're going to actually make new ones effectively based on the same guts?
Yeah, and maybe the 5S will actually then turn around and be the new old phone.
Yeah. Yeah.
So let's call it a 5S Plus that's new.
Yep.
A 6 that's new. But that's the thing. That's actually what sparked this idea in my head in the first place. Wall Street is convinced that, and pundits are convinced that it's going to be the iPhone 6 is going to be the large screen device.
Yeah.
And that doesn't make any sense to me.
Makes perfect sense to me. Why doesn't it make sense to you?
Because the iPhone 5 needs a successor. So the iPhone 5S is in this case, actually.
The iPhone 4S did not need a successor.
It did. It's called the iPhone 5.
So the iPhone 5S needs a successor. It's called the iPhone 6. Same logic.
Correct. But that would be the 4-inch. That would be the premium 4-inch
device. No, because the iPhone 4 was smaller than the iPhone. The iPhone 4S was smaller than the iPhone 5.
Okay, well, then what do you call the premium 4-inch device?
It's called the 5S.
No, they're not going to call next year's. They're not going to release a new 5S.
I don't think they're... See, they did something this year that was unprecedented, right? They effectively renamed the iPhone 5 into the iPhone 5C. Right, the guts were so similar that it basically was the same device.
It was absolutely the same device.
Right, but they put it in a new case.
Yeah,
right, which is cool, great. But if they had not done that, if they had not put it in the new case, it simply would have been the iPhone 5. It still was the iPhone 5.
Correct.
So if they, unless there is some reason to take the 5S and put it in a new case, I think a year from now the iPhone 6 is the premium one. The 5S is the iPhone that it is today.
So
just cheaper.
You're seeing the new iFablet. You're seeing the 5S and then possibly.
See, that's a loaded statement. This concept of calling it an iFablet is not is your choice.
Yes, absolutely.
It's a larger phone.
A larger phone. Right. Yeah. But you're saying that the iPhone 6 would be the iFablet.
Yeah. Yeah. But again, that's sort of a loaded moniker, right? Maybe I'm taking it the wrong way, but iFablet makes me feel like you don't think this can work as a phone. And it's a different discussion.
I've always thought that the term phablet was a great way to describe the large smartphones. It puts Jeff on tilt. I usually say it to Jeff just to.
Yeah. I guess it puts me on tilt a little bit too, because I don't think that size, 5 inches or less, is actually correct for calling it a phablet.
You want to limit phablet to like the Note, the Galaxy Note?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, then for the
sake of... Because I've used an S4.
For the sake of this discussion,
yeah.
I will call it a large screen iPhone.
Okay, because it's a separate discussion. It's a good discussion to have. It's just a separate discussion. So you're
fair enough. You're loading my term up with baggage that I didn't intend. So let's just remove the term, and that way, whoever's actually applying the baggage will not have to apply the baggage.
Will not have to apply the. Oh no, it is my own baggage to apply.
So
definitely.
We've got the iPhone 6 that is a large screen device. We've got the 5S being sold, and then what, the 5C also?
Yeah, I think that's right. 5C, 5S, and 6.
I don't think we're gonna do that. I think we're going to have a large screen device. I think we're going to have a successor to the 5S and a successor to the 5C.
And when you say successor, you're not talking about a successor like the 5C was to the 5.
Correct.
You're talking about something that's actually got more horsepower.
Yeah.
So what's the low-end Apple phone, which again is
the 5S, the current 5S. The 5S remains on the market.
So the 5S becomes the low-end phone, and then this successor to the 5C becomes greater than that?
Yeah, it would have to, yeah.
How confusing this gets, though?
I'm not too comfortable.
There's too many circles on the family tree here.
I'm not too comfortable with that. I'm not sure how the 5C fits into it. What I have a problem with is the notion that the current premium device, because we've heard rumors, and I believe these are very credible, because that the large screen iPhone that the media has dubbed the iPhone 6 will be $100 more.
Okay,
right.
I see what you're saying.
So
sure.
If Apple is starting this large screen iPhone at $299 for a subsidized contract,
yeah, which are also going away, right? I mean, it's important to remember that. The cell phone industry is, again, separate conversation but related. The whole concept of a subsidized iPhone may not exist in 2 years' time.
Maybe. That's another conversation.
Right.
Yeah, Apple has a lot of power there because Apple's customers make the carrier's money, even if they hate it.
Right.
All right. So that's a separate
question. But anyway, it is a separate conversation, yeah.
I do not think that Apple is going to... Within the context of the subsidized industry, I do not think that Apple is going to approach the market next year with a free phone, a $99 phone, and a $299 phone. It'd be free, $99, $199, and $299. And
you think there's going to be four?
Yes.
Boy, that's.
Yeah, I do think there's going to be four. That's.
See, what you're describing.
I'm not sure where the 5C fits into that.
Yeah, and that's why it doesn't make sense, because what you're describing is a very confusing thing for customers, right? You're describing a device that lives between where the 5S is now and where what we'll call the iPhone 6, the larger screen iPhone, would be. And that's something that's slightly more powerful than the 5S and a little bit better.
Well, maybe, so let me describe it a different way. We've got the 5C, today's 5C, at free. Right now it starts at $99.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
Except for the markets where there's an 8 gig model.
Right.
Okay. So you get today's 5C at $99. The successor, I'm sorry, free. Right. Today's 5C at free. The 5C successor at $99. The 5S successor at $199. And then the new large screen device at $299.
Yeah. See, I don't think that's going to happen. And since I'm the guest here, and you asked me what my future iPhone lineup was by the end of the year, I'll trump your just using this as an opportunity to soapbox instead. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Which was absolutely what I was doing.
I know. Oh no, it's great. I love it. I think there's too much confusion there. Now, it's possible you might see it, and let me reframe your own argument here, because this might be more doable. You've got currently the 5C and the 5S. What if we leave those alone, untouched, and we add to that the iPhone 6 small and the iPhone 6 large, right? So you can have the 4-inch iPhone 6 or the 5-inch iPhone 6. I don't think Apple would do that product name-wise, but what if they did that capability-wise? We've got the latest new, super hoopty processors and touchscreen whiz bang stuff and 3D projections that you have to get a clearance from the FAA to use outside, and right, all this stuff. You got to file a NOTAM if you're going to be in the yard using your thing. But let's say they have all these new features and speeds and everything in two phones, one that's 4 inches as the iPhone 5S is now, and one that is larger screen. You know, that
I could see that.
Now maybe there's your differentiator, right? You know, so it's the six small and the six large. I'll leave it up to them to break it up
yet again, because this to me is where the crux of the matter is. First of all, that soapbox. Yes,
that's good.
Will Apple offer the new large screen device that we both believe is coming?
Yes.
Will that be at $299 with the subsidy, or will it be at $199?
What's the S4? What's the S5 sell for with a subsidy right now?
I don't know. Do you want to look it up? I will look.
Yeah, no, I'm looking it up here. I think $199. It'll be $199.
You think it'll be?
That's $199? A 5.1 inch display, and it's $199 for the low end one.
All right. If that's the case, then Apple will have a large screen iPhone, the successor to the 5C, and then the 5S is last year's model. If that's the case, if it's $199, it would Apple would maintain its three tiered structure.
Yeah,
I think Apple's going to go with a four tiered structure. I think they want that $299 price.
I don't think they can. I don't think so. I think it's $199. Subsidized.
Of course, subsidized. Yeah.
Yep.
That would be. Can Apple do that without taking a huge hit to the margins?
I'm pretty sure they can. I don't know for certain, because I don't know what parts are spec'd inside this thing, but yeah, I think so.
You know, if that's the case, the big thing that's going to stink about that is that we won't have a 128 gig option, which I would really like in a phone.
Why wouldn't you have that?
I think that will be one place that Apple would have to not.
They're not going
to
sell you the 128 for $199 subsidized. But I mean, what's wrong with adding $100 and saying, here's your 128? I mean, $100 on top of the 64 and saying, here's your 128.
No, they could do that, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, all right. They could do that. I don't have a strong opinion on that one way or the other. I think we're going to have a four-tiered structure, though, and you think it'll be three.
I definitely think it'll stay at three. Yeah, because it's too confusing. The deltas between these, you know, I mean, the deltas between them are going to be too small to make obvious sense to the customer which way to go. The feature deltas. You know, I mean, you're talking about a feature delta between these middle two. You're saying free $99, $199, and $299. But what you describe between $99 and $199, there wasn't enough of a difference.
But we have that today. The way I'm doing it, I'm adding a new class of device, and we have the same differentiation between those middle tiers as we do today.
No, you're saying that there's going to be something. That the 5S is going to drop to $99, and then there's going to be something else in this 4-inch size that fills the $199 gap.
All right, stick the 5S innards in the 5C case.
Yeah.
Call that the free one. And the 5C is the fly in my ointment. I readily admit to that. But you know, I've been saying since the 5C was released, not since before it was released, but since it was released, and understanding the fact that it costs less to make the 5C.
Right.
The 5C's point was to exist for the second half of the product cycle, not the first half of the product cycle. Because in the second half of Apple's product cycle, that's actually when they start selling more of the low-end devices. Lower end devices, and that it was cheaper for Apple to make the 5C than it is to make the 5, and that's why they bothered to replace this. Is like right now in theory they're selling more of the 5Cs than they were 3 months ago, 4 months ago.
Okay, yeah, no, I buy, but again, I don't know. I think it starts getting to be, you know, we're going to have the iPhone Performa line, and nobody's going to understand what the difference is between any of these models.
Yeah. Well, will you concede this? If I'm right, Apple will have figured out a way to present it appropriately.
Oh, of course. Yeah, I just don't see the need. Because I don't think they can get away with the base level of the iPhone 6, if that's what it's called, and I think that's what it would be called, being $299 subsidized. I think it has to be $199.
All right. Well, we will see. This ended up being an interesting discussion.
Yeah. Really good.
Yeah.
Hopefully, we didn't confuse all of our listeners here with the circular family tree. But
well, I think
we did
pretty well. I'm confused, so it wouldn't surprise me if we confused everybody else too.
Sure.
All right. But that said, we're out of time. So
we are out of time. There's that earnings call coming in, and we need to be ready for that.
Exactly. In 40 minutes, the press release will be hitting, so I got to go. And that's this week's Apple Context Machine. If you have anything to comment on, add, or question, write us at acm@macobserver.com. Thanks for listening, and feel free to follow me on Twitter at TMOBrian. That is Brian with a Y.
And you can follow my account at Dave Hamilton on Twitter. Our content is written by all the great people we have here with us at the Mac Observer. Our bandwidth is provided by the awesome folks at Cashfly, CacheFly.com. The bass is by Boom, recorded for TMO. That's all for this week.
Stay subscribed.
We'll see you online at the Mac Observer.